our subcommittee will come to work. Considering two measures today, HJR 11 and House Bill 11 what?
1178.
HJR 11. We'll start with first, and I'll call on Representative Senator McPherson. Do you want Representative?
Let's let Perry go. Find it off first time.
Okay. Representative Perry.
Go ahead, talk to me.
Are you waiting for the chairman?
No.
Where are you, chairman? Hey, Norm, how about the new room?
You just close the door.
Committee members, my name is Larry Perry. I'm a representative from Eugene, and representing Lane and Benton counties. The HJR 11, House Joint Resolution 11 that you have before you, stems from the recent deadlock in the Senate, and it's an attempt to prevent that from occurring again. You may be aware that in the last eight regular sessions, twice we've had deadlocks, such as the Senate witnessed earlier. And I think during those other sessions, there's frequently been a real possibility of more deadlocks. Okay, the measure will not necessarily eliminate all deadlocks, but it will certainly greatly diminish the possibility. The measure, in short, asks for two things. Three things, I guess, because we're asking for a special election. That would be one item. First of all, if the election occurs as soon as possible. And the measure asks that we add one member to each House, 61 representatives and 31 senators. And the second portion of the measure eliminates the constitutional requirement that senatorial districts follow county lines. We're hoping that this would make reapportionment easier for legislature in session. Question, why now? And rather than wait for either the primary or general election coming up, is that reapportionment is going to be done this year. And so we're concerned that if we're going to add another member to each House, and there are a couple of other measures you need to change the makeup of the House to place that before the people. If we're going to do that, we should do it before the reapportionment occurs this year. Rather than have to reapportion 2 years from now, if the people were to approve an additional member or additional five members or various possibilities being proposed. Second reason for doing it now is the public is very aware of the problem, and so that takes care of a great deal of educating the public as to what the measure is all about and why the measure. The alternative to reapportioning twice is for this session to come up with alternative reapportionment plans. In other words, we could have one put together on the basis of one member added to each House. We could have one put together just the present members of each House, or other combinations. But when you do that, you cloud the issue, and the issue becomes much more political. For example, if this House were to put out alternative measures based on whether or not people might approve additional members, then whether you or I or the general voters support the additional member concept might be dependent on which reapportionment plan he wants to go with. For example, Representative Howard, you might in one plan do very well in terms of voter registration, another not do very well, or voter make safe consideration. So you clouded the issue of trying to break the deadlock by adding on more members to each House. So that would be a reason, another reason for doing it now. Lastly, should the people approve an additional member 2 years from now, some of the voters will have been shifted this time by reapportionment, and they will be should it begin, if another reapportionment has to come up, and they, in other words, changing their representative. And I don't think this is going to be good governmental practice either. So, on the basis of these arguments, we, Senator McPherson, I really believe this would be beneficial to the legislature to act on the town. Do you have any questions?
Well, I just wonder how you feel if this would help. And everybody brings up what happened in the Senate this year. The Democrats had a majority in the Senate of 16 votes. If we had this extra man, what would keep two members of the Senate? And 2 years ago, we had three members of the Senate that were Democrats opposed to Republicans. 4 years ago, we had the same thing. I can't see in 1959, when the House was controlled 31-29 by the Democrats, I was approached by three Republicans that drove to Portland to talk to me about forming a coalition. I didn't form that coalition, and I'm sure if they had looked a little bit further, they would have found somebody that would have formed that coalition.
In order for the
do you think they could overcome a coalition?
No, they will not overcome a coalition. It's not designed to overcome a coalition. But it does overcome a deadlock in that you have to have an even number of people voting to accomplish a deadlock.
We didn't have an even number in the Senate this time.
I believe 30 votes were cast.
We had 30. But when you when somebody crosses that magic line, another member doesn't mean one thing.
Let me try once more. In order to have a deadlock, you have to have an even number of senators voting or representatives. The deadlock would be in the House. This measure would add one member, making that an uneven number in both houses, thereby coming up with a 15 vote possible. In other words, it will not prevent coalition. No way will it prevent the coalition. You could have a coalition with any number. The coalition doesn't cause a deadlock. The House gets organized even with the coalition.
The Senate wasn't organized for 12 days. Only, and some question about whether they were even legal in swearing in the governor, if somebody wanted to question.
The Senate was deadlocked because we had an even number of votes being cast.
If one more joined with the coalition, would have been an even number of votes?
Yes, it still would have been 30 votes.
This will not solve the coalition problem, but it would solve a deadlock. Well, then what? If we're going to amend the Constitution, why don't we amend it that the take out that the House of Representatives shall organize their own body, and just say that if you're elected as a Democrat, you must vote for a Democrat, or vice versa. We're amending the Constitution.
Well, I can see one shortcoming immediately. If the Democrats have 15 members, the Republicans have 15 members, and you're committed by statute to vote for the choice of your caucus, you're going to create the deadlock.
Well, we
by law.
We could change the number along with and solve two problems with one resolution.
Anybody answer your question?
I may offer the amendment.
Wandering here. Party linen. Representative Dan Hardy, yeah. Representative Perry, if there were no special election tax onto your bill, since So we've got two bills, one committee, and this one is in this committee. How would that affect the provisions of this act? Or this, you know, if this were to pass, would you have some difficulties here? Wouldn't these take effect in 1782?
Yes.
I mean, what would happen?
You mean the other measure remaining committed?
You know, we're in a special election.
This measure, the other measure remaining committee, then it will make no difference what happens to this measure. Because the other measure got a funding.
Well, no,
this measure would not be held.
Is there a... Oh, I see it. There's paragraph 2 on page 3, there's special election. This has to be done then at a special election.
That's correct.
Okay. Would you agree or disagree with the statement that we would need other issues on that ballot in order to justify the cost of a special election?
I don't think we need other issues on the ballot to justify the cost.
Would you be opposed to other issues on the ballot?
No. Personally, I don't know if some of the persons you want to have
to add that. Now, you mentioned that one of the provisions of this is that we may cross county boundary lines in senatorial elections. Does this not include, the House? It would not include the House.
My understanding is the House need not follow representative districts, need not follow the county boundary line.
No.
No. Just senatorial.
Is that under a constitutional?
Yes, I think you find it. Section 7. Excuse me, section 2A, subsection 7. The current district shall be composed of.
Well, now, on line 23 and 24, you are deleting language, and it says that no county shall be divided in creating such senatorial district.
Thereby allowing them to be divided.
And then, is this language then from the Constitution, and there is no statement about county boundary lines and representatives?
Correct.
So right now, we could draw a reapportionment plan or representative districts and cross county boundary lines and still be within the spirit of the Constitution. Other questions? You don't.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
Senator McPherson. Senator McPherson.
Chairman, I'm Hector McPherson, Senator from Linn County, often confused as Gordon McPherson. Comes from a nation nearby, but not the same county. I think that what I have to say will simply back up what Representative Perry has already told you. This is a bill to call a special election to do what everyone has been discussing doing, and which I'm sure is going to get done in one form or another very soon. This would simply allow it to be done sooner. I think the only area that Representative Perry didn't cover was the cost angle, because I think it probably is the thing that will weigh most heavily in people's minds. You may recall the last special election that was held on the sales tax, some $300,000 was proposed. Of this, only about $224,000 was actually expended, and so we have discussed with the Secretary of State's office, and he feels he can run a special election for $250,000. This is a figure that you need to know, because to my knowledge, that is one of the biggest drawbacks of this approach. Whether you think that getting these two problems we have with the Constitution, that is one of them, allowing us to break deadlock, allow us to where we could break deadlock automatically by simply having an odd number, and whether we need to at this time change the Constitution so that we could legally do what we're actually going to have to do anyway. As you understand, the federal constitution has already been interpreted that we must come closer to population one man, one vote than we can possibly do by not cutting county lines. Now, it bothers me as a senator to, having sworn to uphold the Oregon Constitution, to deliberately turn around and break that trust by cutting county lines. I would feel much happier, and I think I can go back to my voters and with a better sense of conscience to have this particular provision changed before we actually do our reapportionment. So the entire object of this particular measure is to allow us to do our reapportionment just once and do it and have this election in time so this could take place now. Now, I would be glad to respond to questions. Representative Carr, would you like to have me respond to the question which you posed to Representative Perry on with respect to the Senate situation?
No, I think it will happen no matter what you think. It's going to happen. And my conscience isn't quite that strong on spending $225,000 to solve something that it doesn't solve. It might solve the, if this was offered as a solution to the reapportionment problem. But to sit here and say that we're going to solve the deadlock in the Senate by adding one more member is just wishful thinking, because it's look at the back history, and if you think to solve it by this, you're wrong.
Representative Howard, I might point out to you that in 1943, the contest, which held them up for 3 days, was Bill Stirer against Dorothy McCullough Lee, both Republicans. This has nothing to do with party affiliation. It's not intended to have. That you can have deadlock perfectly well with two Republicans or two Democrats. So that what we need to do to prevent this from happening is so that even no matter how they line up, as long as everyone votes, it comes out with one person getting one more vote than the other side has.
Well, but I don't think they're going to hold it. That's close to constitutional provision. Constitution, you can write everything in here on whether it's a constitutional question or not, if you want. I've been here, and this is the best way to defeat or pass a bill ever. Lawyers and non-lawyers will get up and say, I think we have a constitutional question. And I just don't buy that method of
Dan Horn, I've got a couple, three questions here. First, I'll ask you the same question that I asked Representative Perry on the idea of, do you think that a special election could be justified on just this basis? And maybe that's silly because you've already, in fact, said so. But do you think it would you be opposed to having more than one issue on that ballot if other representatives believe that that's the only way you could justify the cost of special election?
Representative Densmore, I can answer this very clearly in that I first considered adding several things into this because I think there are several measures that might appropriately come before the voters of Oregon at this time. I think the 18-year-old vote is one of these. And had I thought that it would not possibly defeat the measure that I had thought more important, I would have included this in. We deleted it, knowing that other legislation was coming through, which could be tied in with it. Now, one of the provisions of this special election, which was not explained to you so far, any measure passed by the legislature can be put on this particular special election. But no measures can be put in brought up by petition from the people. In other words, this is limited just to those. So it isn't a matter that people out could start passing petitions to, say, reduce property tax to 1% of true cash value or some such measure. These are limited. This special election would be limited to those things proposed by this legislative session.
Now, another question for you. Let's hypothetically say that the House passes the 18-year-old vote, and I believe it's provisional on a primary referral in 72. Could the legislature then place that on the special election ballot?
Yes, they can, but I think it will require an amendment somewhere along the line there before it gets out of the legislature to make it applicable to any special election which might be proposed. In fact, I have thought and haven't yet proposed this bill be amended in case there is a special election, in case we do are successful with it, that it do go on to the special election. But it will require an amendment.
One last question. I think you brought up the chief weakness in your proposal, and it's been outlined before, is that this only helps if you have an odd number voting. Do you think that political pressures or pressures from constituents would be strong enough to keep on an odd number voting?
You're asking me if you might put the vote up among three people and therefore still get a few votes?
No, I'm asking. Let's say that we have 31 members in the Senate, or about 61 members in the House, and one member, for whatever reason, decides not to vote, not there, does not vote. Do you think, and that really it negates the intent of your bill, and that's the chief argument against it, do you think political and constituent pressure will be enough to force that individual to vote?
Well, all I can do is to go back into the history of this thing, and I think you will find, if you go back into, I've forgotten the exact year, but it was back in the 1860s when you will find they had a deadlock, which was caused by the fact that some proportion of the senators voted blank. In other words, when the name came up, they voted blank. This could still happen, but I don't think that there's been any interpretation on this recently. I think possibly that the Constitution actually would rule this out if it were interpreted this way. As far as I know, in modern times, no one has ever done that.
Could the body compel the attendance and vote of that member?
Specifically, yes. Now, we ran into this little problem on the Senate side to recount for you what actually happened on that fateful Friday morning in which we tried to get the vote on one particular time, and we had a walkout on one certain party, which didn't allow a quorum. As long as you don't have a quorum, you cannot have a call of the Senate. Had we been able to muster quorum, we could have sent the sergeant at arms out to physically bring the people in. And as you recall, if you study back your history again, there's a famous episode where some members of the legislature actually hid out in the barn, and the sergeant at arms couldn't find them and couldn't bring them in physically. And I suppose there's always a possibility for this, but I don't think this is too likely. If you can muster a quorum, you can get everybody in there and make them vote.
Well, if you can't muster a quorum, then...
If you can't muster a quorum, you're in trouble.
Questions? No, thank you very much, Mr. McPherson.
Thank you very much.
Are there others signed there on the... Are there others who would like to testify on House Joint Resolution number 11? Come ahead, please. Bill. Representative Phelan, would you like to do it now?
I have very little to say.
Go ahead, sit down. We like that kind of testimony.
Well, I know I have very little to say. I want to appear in support of this. I'm Nancy Fabry, representative from Lane County. I just want to suggest something for you to think about for a slight change, and I don't mean to be destroying the whole reason for this legislation. Don't you think it'd be a good idea if you had exactly...
Yeah. Oh, I think it's just... I don't know how to make it work. Why not? Go ahead.
What do you think about having twice the number of representatives that we have senators? So that when you're drawing legislative districts, you don't only have to draw one. I mean, those of us who've been trying to figure out the reapportionment plan know that it's hard enough to figure out.
So you're saying 62, 31, 62.
I'm wondering if you should consider that.
Question for Representative Taylor. Pardon me, do you want to run that one by me again?
When you're deciding how many members should be in each body, what do you think about making the number in the House exactly twice the number in the Senate? So that after you have drawn your senatorial district, next job would be with Houston.
Representative Multnomah County, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appear here today to oppose this resolution. I think there's a number of questions involved here. I think it's already been brought out. Number one, would the voters of Oregon, would our constituents look kindly upon us spending $250,000 for a special election so that we could satisfy ourselves in our various houses that we might not have a deadlock again? I rather doubt it. The question of 6131, are we trying to lessen the workload for the members of the legislature by increasing the numbers? If we are, I think we should increase it more and we could satisfy the needs and the sharing of the workload in the legislature even more. If we're trying to create more members of the legislature to bring the legislature closer to the people, a larger number of legislators would do this more adequately. If we're trying to add or help from Eastern Oregon from losing members of the legislature that they presently enjoy, 3161 would not do it. I personally feel that reapportionment means more to us in the legislature than perhaps it does to some of our constituents. I think that if we were to have a special election, in order to justify the cost, we should do it in combination with some other things that have to be done. I think that there could be some money saved if we submitted the 18-year-old vote. We're going to have two sets of bookkeeping for the voter. There could be some money saved if we were to submit a constitutional amendment increasing the size of the legislature. If we get it now, while we are already paying someone and have the data processing, the computer set up to do it. However, to do it for one member in the Senate and one member in the House, I do not think would be constructive on our part at this time.
Question for Representative McPherson,
aren't you supporting Plan 59-29? Would you have a billing on that or something? Or if I got you mixed up with someone else?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, I think you have me mixed up with someone else.
I don't have you mixed up, Harvey. I just may have your name on the wrong bill. Do you support that plan?
I would think that rather than waste $250,000 of the taxpayers' money on a special election, that we could do something if the only thing we want to accomplish is to eliminate the possibility of deadlock, that this would be a better idea. We can do this by statute, decrease the size. The Constitution says shall not exceed 30, shall not exceed 60. We could decrease the size of the legislature and prevent a deadlock if that's all we're trying to do.
But what I'm really trying to get at is not whether, just talking about two different concepts, not when we hold the election. I understand the reapportionment problems inherent in when you hold the election, but just to say, forget the reapportionment problem. Do you support a concept of 61, stay the way we are, or reduce?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. McPherson, I support the concept of increasing the membership of the legislature. I feel that the workload, particularly in the Senate, is quite heavy, and that we should share the burden of that work.
And so
6131 really wouldn't be spreading the burden at all. I would increase it more members.
I would agree with you, and I hope there continues to be bipartisan support for that idea in lieu of reducing it, because I don't know about you, but I'm too busy. I'm sure you are too.
For the question, Mr. Representative Anderson. Representative Aiken, what is your opinion of the cost of a special election? You stated something as I was coming in. $250,000, $300,000
Well, I think the figure was used at $250,000. The last special election we had on a tax maker was we appropriated $300,000, and I think the Secretary of State turned back some $65,000, $70,000.
Are you aware, Mr. Chairman, of where the cost of a special election arise? The difference between, for instance, the cost of holding the election and the cost of paying certain governmental employees days off?
Well, I think
what in actuality is the physical cost of holding an election, a special election? Well, let's say that certain people affected were not affected. It was not a legal holiday for them. What would the cost of an election be?
If it were a legal holiday? And
no, it were not. If we had an election on specific items which you have covered potentially, if it were not a legal holiday, the costs were only those costs of poll watchers, etc., poll books, holding an election.
Well, I understood the figure was somewhere between $225,000 and $250,000.
That's the total thing.
Now, you see, what you're thinking about is last time we waived the legal holiday thing. So there was not the additional cost that would have been involved had we not done that.
What's the fact that we passed a little bit last time on legal holidays for certain days, and we took away elections as a holiday?
They are no longer a holiday.
So your actual figure
is the physical cost of holding a special election, not paying certain employees to be off on that day, still remains roughly $250,000.
That's correct. Now, the justification, you can say that there would be, if you just held an election on this particular issue, you would have, I suppose, some slight savings because you do have the data, computer tapes and data, and the agency hired to help us in the reapportionment at this time. Now, if this were submitted to the voters in the general election 1972 and the 73 legislature had to reapportion itself, I assume that they would have to hire some additional help. So perhaps there would be a saving if it went to a special election, but nowhere near the $250,000. Now, in response, if I might, Representative Fadley mentioned the fact that it would be nice if we could have the House double membership of the Senate. Of course, if we do that, then the House has the possibility of a deadline. I don't feel that the House districts have to correspond with the Senate districts at all. They can be, we can cut the state up into equal population districts for the Senate and equal population districts for the House. And by using the sub-district method, have multi-member districts.
Thank you, sir.
Further questions?
Thank you, sir. Yes.
I'm Earl Moore. Registered as a lobbyist for the Oregon State Grange, but I would like to speak on this as an individual living in Hood River County. And I think that this is a move that should be made in order to eliminate the deadlock like we've had several times in the past in the Senate. And then as a resident of Hood River County, you might know that I'm on the fringes of this Eastern Oregon that you talk about here when it comes to apportionment. And by adding this one member, it would take away a little bit of the possibility of Eastern Oregon losing members in the representation. I'm aware of the fact that they're going to lose, but you have one more member here. It might make a difference between keeping one or losing one when you come down to the last one. That's the thing that I'm trying to say. And when it comes to adding more than 31 and more than the one, having 31 and 61, I think you run into a physical problem here in the Capitol building. It might be fine to have 35 and 65, but where are you going to accommodate them without a building program? And this, I believe, that the people of Oregon would be more opposed to than they would a special election. These are some of the things that I see. I think we do need, I'm speaking about it on a nonpartisan basis. I think that's something that doesn't always get here in the legislature. Nonpartisan look at it. I think we should add so it eliminates this possibility of deadlock. Mr. Chairman, that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Representative Howard.
Mr. Moore, I can go along with hope that we wouldn't have to take a senator away from Eastern Oregon, but I can't go along with the idea that you're doing away with the deadlock by adding one member. And I would remind you that there were 16 Democrats and 14 Republicans in the Senate. And we just went through a 12-day deadlock. And what would difference would have made if we had had one more man?
It added 15, 16 votes, is what we did.
That's, and wouldn't have made a bit of difference in it. I sympathize, as I say, and I would hope that if this is drawn in on its merit, but, and if your merit would be, as far as I would be concerned, that if we had 31, there was already in the Senate, that Hood River County would probably keep their state senator. I buy that and sympathize with it and probably could support it. But to have somebody come in and tell me that this is going to solve, especially when we've just gone through three times down here where the Democrats had the majority of the Senate, but that was organized by the Republicans. I can't buy one part of your argument, the other I would go along with.
Well, Representative Howard, I would say this, that this won't eliminate any party politics in the legislature.
This is what it's been all the time, is party politics, not a tie vote. Now, your basic is...
You
didn't
have any party politics.
Quit shaking your finger at
party politics is what it is, and this doesn't answer the party politics method. I buy your, and I would probably support it if they were just saying that Eastern Oregon would keep their senator. But this folder all about no tie vote isn't doing much for me.
Representative Dinsmore.
Mr. Moore, I think I'll just keep asking the same question to everyone. I have received communications from the Grange that they would oppose a special election on this, at least from my area, on this particular matter.
do you think that the Greens would oppose a special election on a number of issues potentially that are crucial and are imperative that we decide before 1972?
Well, of course, I can't really answer for the Grange on that. My personal thinking would be that we have several important issues here to put them on the election at the same time. This would ordinarily justify a special election. I don't think there would be too much to do. Again, personally, I don't think there would be too much opposition.
You know, one of the things that I sort of was amused at while the press was having a heyday with the Senate, you know, 32 weeks that they were deadlocked, and a lot of people wrote a lot of letters to the editors saying that there were a bunch of pot-bellied old fellows over there costing the state an awful lot of money. But don't you think that in the end, if we're out of here by the end of May, the actual cost to the citizens of the state is not going to be any more except for normal inflationary factor of raises in legislative staff salaries than it was in 1969. The cost actually, there will be no additional cost factor except for inflationary rates. In fact, it took 2 weeks to elect the president. Isn't going to make an iota of difference. So I'm wondering why we're going to all this trouble. Because I think Norm is right. I can visualize a roll call vote: 15 for Lance, 15 for Newberry, and 1 for Potts. You still haven't solved it.
What I hear, though, around people, they're pretty upset when things happen like this tie of load.
Yes, they are, I agree.
Some remedy for it, I think it is time to come.
Well, I'm wondering, though, if adding one is the answer, if in fact we had a situation like this, we could still possibly have a tie and a deadlock with 31 people in the Senate.
It's possible, yes, it's almost possible.
My recollection is that nothing binds a member to vote for any of the formal nominees. All members of the Senate would be eligible to be president, and you can cast your vote for any member of that body that you wish. So, I don't know. Highly unlikely, I suppose, that would happen, but it's highly unlikely that there's a tie, too. In fact, there wasn't expected to be a tie this time. Yeah, the coalition was supposed to live on, but it didn't. I personally, I know the people are upset, because they think we cost them a lot of money for that 2 week period. But in the final analysis, I just don't think that the results will show that we would be here 2 weeks longer because the Senate took 2 weeks, because all the while the House was working and carrying on business. And it could be wrong. So what I'm saying to you is, I guess maybe that I just don't see the problem.
I have great confidence in the people of Oregon. I think they'll take care of it. I think they'll take care of it.
May I ask Mr. Moore a question and not deliver a statement? Mr. Moore, you are, at least the discussion is on two different sides of it. One is breaking a deadlock, and the other, and you've related to this, was enabling Eastern Oregon to have a closer representation. This is something Representative Akinson has brought up in his
35-65 plan. One question I would have, are you speaking to both issues? Because 31-61 is going to gain Eastern Oregon no more than 30-60. Because you only gain about 600 bodies per seat in the House. So Eastern Oregon, per se, is going to lose equally between 60 and 61. Are you speaking to Eastern Oregon and the deadlock, or just to the deadlock? Are you interested in Eastern Oregon increasing the body so that Eastern Oregon retain the seat or even increase it?
Well, I'm interested in Eastern Oregon keeping all the representation they can.
You would have to go to approximately 63 to keep what you have. 65 would increase the margin somewhat. 61 will not maintain what Eastern Oregon has now. They're still going to lose the seat.
I understand that, but I fail to see where adding really gives us any more of an edge than we would have without it.
I'm interested, are you speaking to just the deadlock, or are you speaking to both the deadlock and retaining representative and or senator seats for Eastern Oregon?
Well, both.
I'm
interested in both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moore. Appreciate you. Are there further witnesses on HR 11? Now that I'm closed the hearing on HR 11, I'd like to turn to Office 1178. Here he comes, Representative Grant. Perfect timing. Kathleen, would you like to come up and join us?
I'm Representative Graham from Multnomah County, speaking on House Bill 1178, which has to do with legislative reform. As you all know, this is one of a number of bills that are before the legislature concerning more frequent meetings of the legislature to meet the needs of the people of the state. This bill is unique in one form in that aspect. For the members of this committee, I think the thing that has to be decided first is whether they wish to have that type of reform, whether they wish to have more frequent meetings of the legislature itself. And if they do, then they must choose the vehicle to do such. I think you probably all know the various arguments for having more frequent meetings of the legislature. So I won't review those, but go in particular parts of this bill which make it unique. Discussing the problem of more frequent means of meetings of the legislature, the crux matter appears to be the passage of bills if and when we adjourn. You all know the 90-day limitation on the enactment or implementing the bills that have been passed by the legislature after the session is over. This bill is not very long. It doesn't take very long to read. There's just lines 8, 9, 10, and 11 are the essential parts of it. Having the legislature meet for 2 days every month following the initial session, which is what we're going through now. Now, the problem that usually arises is, do we need a constitutional amendment to change our present structure to this? And by means of this bill, I would assert that we do not need a constitutional amendment to do this change. Secession is not defined in statutes anywhere. It's used alternately, and I think I'll ask Kathleen to talk on this for a moment. How secession is used in the statutes, since this is the crux matter. If we adjourn, does that mean we have to adjourn at the end of what we consider a session, or is it a daily session, or is it a two-day session, or what is the matter there? As you can read in section 2, line 12, for purposes of section 1 and 28 of Article 4 of the Oregon Constitution, the adjournment of each session described in section 1 of this act shall be considered the end of that session. Do it by statutory means. I think I'll ask for questions, refer to Kathleen.
Kathleen, do you want to say anything?
No.
Doug, I'm trying to get this in my mind.
If the end of a two-day session, adjournment of each session, be considered at the end of each session.
Shall be considered at the end of the session.
End of the, I mean the two-day session. Right. The little two-day session. Which adjourned. I mean the legislation was introduced in July, could not come up again at the August, it has to be reintroduced at the August session.
That's right.
Then how do you, just mechanically, how do you ever get any?
Because the end of the 2 days, July 3rd and 4th are Monday and Tuesday of July, the end of July 4th, and Article 28 says that these measures will be implemented 90 days following the session, and that's what will occur, because that's the end of the session, according to the statute.
Well, my point is, it takes so many days that you got to read a bill one day and refer it the second day tomorrow. Are we going to actually consider legislation, or are we just going to act as a large emergency board?
I would hope that we would consider legislation that would be prepared by continuing interim committees. And that's a concurrent bill that will be coming in too, establishing interim committees that would work continuously during the off year and prepare legislation which would be acted upon by the monthly legislature.
Well, Kathleen? Kathleen, I'm still trying to figure out, we have to go through the formalities. Am I not correct that at the end of this session, all the bills are dead that haven't been acted on and they have to be reintroduced?
That has been the practice. Chairman, I don't know whether I can exactly put my finger on anything in the Constitution that says that. That's been in practice that you're right.
90 days says that.
Well, we would then the bills could carry over for action at future sessions if we had, if this bill passed one in the law. Bills in this committee at the end of the regular session could then be considered at subsequent two-day sessions throughout the following year and a half.
Well, I think Mr. Anderson lifted eyebrow on that point, that isn't that what sign and die means, is if you quit and start all over again, quite possibly. I don't think you can find that in the Constitution. And when you look to the case law in these areas, it's pretty thin and few and far between. So I think you have a question there. For instance, I would think you wouldn't necessitate reprinting of a bill. Because if you want to say we want to consider the bill we printed last session that we left on the table, I don't think it raises any question that you couldn't proceed to do so.
Wouldn't that depend on the sign and die resolution?
It would that. It might also depend on the particular rules which you choose to adopt to govern yourself.
Except you're setting off the 90-day period.
That's the point, that you have to have a point of finality, is to count the 90 days for that and also to count the 90 days for the purpose of the referendum.
That would be your intention, then, that we would have continuous interim committees.
That's correct.
And
The intercommittee would make a report, and we would come in and on 2 days, we would either pass or defeat what they had said. Now, with not more than 2 days, just take the welfare situation, for instance, deficit. You imagine that we as a legislative group would have the problem we do now could just meet for 2 days and solve that. Even if we had a report from an intercommittee.
Well, I would suggest that you look to our present situation in that. What we are acting on now, I would submit, is less information than we would receive from this. We are acting now either as an emergency board or as our session counselor. One of the two things. The emergency board is acting on short work. 1 day, 2 hour, 4 hour sessions, or maybe sometimes longer.
But that's what I don't agree with, Doug, so I don't want to turn right around and...
Well, that's what I'm saying. This would provide us with more information because we would be having interim committees which could meet continuously as they need to meet, and then prepare the legislation simply as this committee does now. Prepares it, passes it out, it comes to the floor, one of the members presents it on the floor to the legislative assembly, as it would be done in this manner.
Well, wouldn't we have to have a lot more interim committees?
I wouldn't say more. I'm suggesting 11, as was the advisory committee's report. And these committees would have to adjust their own schedules, but I'm sure what they would do is adjust their schedules to meeting in the evenings and weekends and things of this nature.
Well, then would you favor that if we did that other members of the legislature that were not on the interim committee would have expenses to come in so that they would be able to sit in like they're able to sit here, so when they got to the meeting, they would already be versed on what was being discussed?
I'm not sure I follow you, but I think what you're saying is that everybody would have funds to go to whatever committee meeting they would want to, and I could concur with that. No, I would think that they'd have funds to go to their own interim committee meetings, but that's not part of this bill. That's a concurrent bill.
Meetings that have been met in this session for 2 years, we can straighten out that national welfare.
No, that's what I'm...
Well, I think there's a good example here of what happened. It was almost 2 months following the last session when the adoption case problem came up here in the state, and there was no way in the world to take care of that except by trying to circumvent it with AG opinions, court cases, and other things, other than what was needed, which was statutory law. There was no way to take care of that. 16 months.
You know, nobody brings it more than I do and realizes more than I do. For the legislature to assume their responsibility, we have to meet more. My question is whether this is really to I will go one way or the other on it, because I think that the public is shortchanged by the emergency board action we have now.
Representative Max Pearson.
This isn't the bill I thought it was when I signed it. But it's getting there, and I thought what we were getting at was I didn't realize it was authorized the regular session in addition to the donor and that.
It
does, right. Yeah. I thought it was a meet, for a couple of days during each month. Week or something like that during the don't you see it as the interim committees doing their work, for example, like the litter subcommittee, we did our work, we made our recommendations in bill form, then at the end of when they make a recommendation, as I see your plan, it's submitted then, our committee report in the 2 day session is voted on, is that right?
Right.
Either it becomes law or it fails.
Right.
If it fails, I suppose that it has to be reintroduced or a new subject to introduce to. Or at least they don't have to have any introduction. Couldn't they, by rule, Kathy, couldn't we set up something that the interim committee reports could be,
would have the authority to pass measures with recommendations to the general session.
If you don't have any constitutional provision,
yeah,
say a word about committee structure.
So you could do what we're doing now. In other words, you can keep going to committee meetings and hold your 2-day session and have it all over with the debate and all that.
Well, I was thinking about if you were doing that and you were meeting 2 days out of the month, or maybe three. I see this as not more than 2 days. That bothers me a little bit. I prefer the weekly. Wellness bills, I think, a week out, or you're authorized to meet a week. Then he cuts out the regular session entirely. Yes, he cuts out the regular session entirely, and you meet for 1 week in every month throughout the whole biennium.
I can
and
see
it turns out that you're actually meeting in less time, spending less money than you are right now.
This
bill, I don't have any pride in authorship or anything of that nature at all. I simply wanted to introduce to you another vehicle that might be, when you put all these bills together and hopefully come out with one of them, that you can utilize various parts of them to come up with the ideal bill. And this part of this vehicle here, I think, will take care of that one question which seems to stop everybody when we start it, is the constitutional amendment for the end of the session. And I hope that that can contribute that part to this reform. No, I think to answer the other question about, do the regular sessions continue like we have now, I think the transition period is going to be rather difficult if and when this occurs, and I think it will occur sometime, if not in the immediate future. The transition period will be difficult, and I think there will probably be a need for at least the first time around to have one session come up afterwards to try and straighten out some things that probably went wrong. And there's no restriction under this situation to change it altogether. You can go to a week. If we switched out here, you can just amend this thing out and say a week or whatever you wanted. A week here. There's nothing that says that you have to meet regularly either. So you could meet for your 2 days beginning in the regular session according to the Constitution. 2 days later, call it and say we'll meet again next month for 2 days. So, or your week.
I've had conversations with you, and we've talked about this about an hour, and we all agree, and other legislators all agree. I'll admit that you went around and looked at all the bills that had to do with revamping the method by which we meet. You'd find 80% of legislators that co-sponsored one of these bills. But obviously, you're the only one here to testify today, Wonder what happened to them as a purely a informational question. How are we ever going to get all the ideas together and change the system? It's not this bill, it's some other bill.
Well, I think the two that I've seen are Senate bills, and I would hope that they'd be referred to this committee so that you can keep track of what's going on and eventually come out with the right thing. I don't know how you deliberate in this body, but in other committees, we deliberate about what it is and try to come up with a good bill out of several sometimes.
Well, my point is, here it is. One legislator here today to back this bill, I wonder if it'll be the same with the other bills.
I would imagine. I had called to testify on the health department reorganization at the same time at 1:30 today at government reorganization across the hall. And I have another committee meeting at the same time, which I'm missing. And I'm sure you all have the same problems with conflicts. I'm sure that everybody's occupied those places. Simply, who has the information closest to hand?
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, did you
want to
ask a question?
No,
in answer to the representative from Lincoln County, we held a hearing on the legislature allowing itself to call itself into special session this morning, and no one showed up. No sponsors whatsoever. Period. I don't recall who was on that. Representative Graham, I'm not going to hold you. I have one serious thing that I want to stick into you. One, you do not cover us calling ourselves into annual session, which you spoke to in coming up with a total plan. And I think calling ourselves into special session should be a part of this and another bill that Representative Pearson spoke to. I question on your bill whether I want to come to the legislative session on New Year's Day, which is called for. I don't think you do either. But the question I wanted to get to, you talked about your resolution talks to the legislature meeting regularly, which I think perhaps may be a darn good idea. I have reservations on limiting it to 2 days as Mr. McPherson does. But you made some talk about committees, interim committees. Would you include in this the necessity that standing committees be interim committees at a small number level, rather than abandoning committees and appointing 3 to 5 interim committees and task forces? Would you recommend, in addition to this, that the number of standing committees be reduced, which the House has done, and they be standing and meeting in addition to the joint House meeting?
Yes, if I can go on with that.
Go ahead.
It's not applicable, particularly this bill, but it's current with this bill. It's
a way
part of workable. Right. The idea here is to have standing committees, which are a smaller number, which are continuous, that go from our regular session right on in. So you have the same people operating, you're attacking the same bills. You don't have a situation where you're talking about public lands and submersible, and then you start with a new committee, they have to be re-educated, go through the whole process again, and you come up with usually nothing at the end of that time. So that we have that continuum, continuum of knowledge of the legislators and a continuum of interest and a discontinuance of bad bills. You're not coming up with the same thing we introduced right over again to a new group. Yes, I'd see a standing committee arrangement of a smaller number, 11 is in the bill, that is continuous.
Do you have any handle, Doug, on 2 days as a man?
Not at all.
It's just the theory of meeting.
That's three. Right.
Thank you.
How would this affect special session? Could the governor still call us into an additional session?
Yes, they certainly could, but under the present law, that's correct. Well, I could, but I doubt if there's any need if we were going to be here within 2 weeks or so. There'd be no need for it. I think Representative Pearson's point on cost is something to consider. How much is this going to cost? And it could be equivalent. I don't see it being reduced in cost in any way, but I do see it being equivalent. Probably not the first year or first 2 years, because there's still, I would think, be a need for a regular session, if I can put those terms on, a regular session to straighten out the problems and get it into functioning order.
Further questions?
How do you think the lobby would view this?
Well,
maybe I'd ask one of them.
I think that would be a good, but some of them would favor it, some of them would not favor it. The people's, if I can put that term on, people's lobby, people that are lobbying for blind or adopted agencies, health regulations, things of this nature are much in favor. I think the professional lobby would probably be opposed to it. Certainly, one of the things that this attack greatly is the bureaucracy problem. The bureaucracy, I think, is, in my feeling, my opinion, is very happy to see us go home and at the end of 6 months. And we would have a constant eye on the agencies and the bureaucracy around the state with this type of legislation, and they would be very unhappy about us being here or continuously.
There's nothing wrong with that.
It's not a thing in the world.
Other questions?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's fine. Representative Skelton had to leave today. He left a note. I would not be present to testify in House Bill 1178, which I favor. However, I believe that House Bill 1275 is a better approach because it is more elastic. You have that elastic bill?
Further testimony on Bill 1178.
You're under arrest.
1178.
You're a sponsor.
Fine. If not, that closes the subcommittee hearing on that bill. I can bring up a couple of things. Before the advance of the subcommittee, we had a recognized problem by all of us. House Bill 1048, that building code, is just a horrendous long piece of legislation, something we're going to work at. I talked to the Bar Association, and Dave Frost, former representative, is going to be down here for 2 weeks in March. And I have got him on loan from the Bar to go over that bill from A to Z, not to, to try to sit down with all the groups involved. There is a great misunderstanding by a lot of people of actually what the bill does. So I think the committee wants to be educated along with it, but it's fine. I thought that Dave Frost brings both a legal background and legal ability and also some legislative background as just how where all the bodies are buried.
Well, leave those cemeteries
out. Oh.
I had to put that up because I'm not going to be here tomorrow. Bill 1275.
Unless it's discussed,
just too far down the line. If not, I think it is in government reorganization.
As a matter of fact, we just tied up on it.
1275? You tied.
Yeah. I think I
was. No, 1291.
1275.
Something to do with the Legislative Assembly.
Calling itself back into session. Right. Okay, just requesting the Attorney General's opinion as to whether it was legal. Not in these billboards.
It's in the big billboards.
Government affairs.
Grab on the big billboards.
As soon as we go to the Attorney General's opinion, we'd be happy to.
Ask me to come over and sit with us.
We did fill the hearing this morning. I don't know if Bill does the same.
Now, this must be in the touch up the week.
No, this bill, 1275, is a bill that will permit the legislative assembly to call it itself back in session with a 2/3 vote.
Let around here, majority. I'll be right back.
Well, we just changed our majority.
Well,
we may
pass out majority. What does it say? I wish to
hell we knew what other committees were doing. It says authorizing
the
session of the legislative assembly
by joint resolution.
We've got a 31-6. The Senate has been requested upon written request majority of members of each house, and we changed ours and voted it out at 2/3.
No, it's not constitutional.
You've been buying your insurance in Montgomery by way of.
Not
constitutional.
No. The way it would work is we change our rules and we'd never read it adjourned.
When do you, how do you make the bill stick?
What? Well, it's a very complicated procedure that only
the build-up bond place.
We've been abolished rather than
monthly related to what you're doing.
Are we adjourned? Is that Dave going?
No, we're not adjourned. I'm not sure why. I'm going to adjourn myself for adjournment.
Rich? Are we having a meeting?
It's got to be about the brightest thing. I don't know, but the only thought I had, if I put you on a hook, I'd get a steel hit with that jacket.
A freshman is a man who carries his first bill to the floor of the house to have it postponed till the next day.
I think you got that much more time to prepare when I ask you the same question I asked in here.
Did you get the same answer?
You're billing down as an emergency cost,
huh? What?
Revenue sharing.
A motion to adopt the amendment.
So move.
Where are they? Well,
just a second.
They're right
there. They're right next to you.
Amendments. Oh, they're right here. Proposed amendments to HJR 1. Provided, however, that the application contained in this resolution shall be deemed effective only if prior to the Congress issuing a call for a convention, Congress enacts some legislation, so forth. The ground rule. This is the Skelton suggested amendment. Representative Anderson moves for adoption of those minutes dated, I mean those amendments dated February 9th. Discussion. Being on the first call roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Dinsmore?
No.
Howard? Pearson?
Aye.
Mark?
Aye.
About a month ago, I had to go to the Finance and Affairs Committee to consider a certain matter having to do with smokeless and kind of explosive powders and so forth. And 1167, 68, 69, and 71 were heard by this committee about corrections. What was the time?
Well, he gave me those numbers again.
1167, 68, 69, and 71.
I think that one of those rings fell. Dinsmore and I are
friends with you about one
of those. Well, that was
really
around that cigar.
What's the numbers? 1167.
1167.
Joe. Sim?
Yeah.
What's his name?
There weren't any questions on that one.
On 67?
Yeah.
We had a hearing on this?
Yeah, we had a hearing. I was here for most of the hearing on that.
I'll vote no on that, but you can take a vote on it.
I'd like to do something. We're going to, you know, the bills are flowing in this committee at the rate of like 10 or 15 a day.
We need to vote on that now.
clarification. Is this the bill? This is the women's protection?
No, that's the next one. Changes language to what they're doing now anyway.
No?
Yes, it does. Puts authorization to administer the correctional probation to sign agreements for placement to get them out of the training school and into home. And that's what they've been doing for the last 18 months.
Yes.
Move 1167 out of the subcommittee to the full committee do pass.
Then Anderson moves House Bill 1167 to the whole committee do pass. Discussion? Max, do you have?
No, I can't have a discussion, not because I asked him. I told him I was going to vote no on this bill. He was present at a work session to better explain it to us. So I'll continue to vote no.
Did he ever get back to you?
No, I told him that we would call him when we were going to have a work session. I didn't know we were going to have a work session today. But that's all right. Go ahead.
Call the roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Dinsmore?
No.
Pearson?
No.
Martin?
Aye. All right. Still committee. House Bill 1168. Change the name. Women's Correctional Center. Then Anderson moves it to the committee to pass.
Does this go to William Dean?
No.
It's going to cost more money.
What's going to cost more money?
Well, you're giving that female a higher title. In fact, William Dean should review it.
Mr. Chairman,
right?
I can't affect the quorum or anything here, but
he did last time.
Go ahead.
I mean, three members of the quorum,
yeah.
So you do what you want to do. But I feel basically that it might have been better had I known when we had a work session that these bills were going to be brought up for discussion and action, so that I could review them and had time to read them a little more carefully. And so I frankly think we ought to wait until Friday.
Our problem is there's going to be a stack of bills in here, and we've got to make this thing. We probably have to take some action afterwards. The best time to take it is immediately after having a hearing. How do you feel about 1168?
No.
You feel no?
Why
don't we postpone it then for Friday? That's what you hear.
What you hear?
Oh, I'll vote no if that's.
No, I realize. So,
I don't care. I'm not going to pass out any bad bills, no matter how long I'm here, without knowing what the hell they are.
How about 1169? Thank you.
To hear today is House Bill 1373, which is
to TORS 164.355 relating to the transportation of hay. We have our hay expert here, one of our hay experts, Representative Stafford.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is bill is known as the repeal of the Hay-Napper Act, which is sponsored by myself, by Senator Carson, Representative Roberts, and Senator Hartung. The purpose of repealing this particular statute is, first, it is a tremendous inconvenience to most of the farmers in the state of Oregon who raise and sell any hay, that every time they sell even one single bale of hay, that they have to give the individual a receipt. The purpose of the legislation to begin with was to give the police some instrument for hay stealing, principally in eastern Oregon, so that the police could stop an individual with a truckload of hay, and if he didn't have a hay receipt, he'd be in violation of the law. Now, anyone can buy these receipts from the state agency, and they cost 50 cents a pad, and I'm sure people that steal hay know where they can buy their hay receipts and write themselves out a receipt. You might be interested in knowing that Senator Newbery's son was on the way to a dance one night with a bale of hay in a station wagon and got stopped by the police. Wanted to know what he's done with that bale of hay. I don't want to interject here that the fact that it is illegal to transport a bale of hay in the state of Oregon, but you can carry all the explosives you want. I don't want to mention that.
Well, Representative Samuel, I don't think that's pertinent.
The
other bill
isn't
in this committee.
No. And that you have to have a receipt when you purchase hay, but you do not have to have a receipt to purchase some dynamite.
Good point.
But, you know,
hay is bound.
What's really almost ludicrous in the law, you can go buy a television set and put in the back of the pickup or almost anything, refrigerator or a freezer, but for some reason, if you buy a bale of hay or any number of bales of hay, you've got to have a hay receipt. And it just seems to me that this particular one type of requirement on one product is about ridiculous. And to quote Senator Carson, who was then a representative and made some very distinguished words on the floor of the House as a representative, that it was probably the worst piece of legislation that was ever passed in the state of Oregon, and how he just loved to get another shot at it. And I am here to help Senator Carson get another shot at this, what in his words is the lousiest piece of legislation ever passed in the state, the fact that you have to have a hay receipt, an inconvenience to the farmer. No sound rhyme or reason to it. Be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Representative Stafford.
Is there a hay coordinating
board
for you?
Is there a hay what?
Hay coordinating board.
A hay coordinating board. No, but I imagine that this legislature will probably start one.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Howard.
I was here when this was passed. I remember right, there was a large delegation of hay farmers from Plymouth Falls, Ontario, Hamilton, and I noticed on this bill, outside of you, there's Senator Carson, Senator Roberts, and Senator Hartung, and they're all in non-hay areas. You mentioned that Senator Newbery's son was stopped with a bale of hay. Is this the reason for this bill?
No, Representative. The reason for the bill is that we do have a lot of people in my county who raise hay, and in most counties of the state, and they sell the hay. They don't sell it in the quantities in these stories. They sell one bale or 10 bales or 50 bales in those quantities. And it's just a tremendous inconvenience to the farmer who sells the hay, and it's an inconvenience to the purchaser of the hay. And in the event they forget to give the individual the hay receipt, he can get arrested. Now, the hay growers in eastern Oregon, I imagine that they like the bill. I imagine the state police like the bill, just like they would like controls on everything, that coffee and so on. But it's a tremendous inconvenience, first, to the small farmer that's raising a small amount of hay. It's an inconvenience to the purchaser, and there isn't any sound rhyme or reason to it. That why we make an individual that buys a bale of hay has to have a receipt where he can go buy almost any product there is in existence, and he doesn't have to have a receipt to haul it down the road.
I don't suppose we'd have very many people write in on this bill, because it's impossible to tell what it does by reading the bill, because it just says that it appeals to ORS, and very few people know. Where does the support for this bill come from? Who asked you to introduce it? Is there a group of individuals that are interested in it?
You bet. Farmers in my county are interested in the repeal of the Hay Napper Act.
I wonder if the farmers in Klamath Falls, they were the ones who were here after. I know. Are you here to testify, Rick?
I am. There undoubtedly are many farmers in the state that are in favor of this law. I think that's correct. Just as if you were going to require a receipt for almost any product, I imagine the people some of the people that are involved in that product would love to have a receipt required to transport it. But it's an expense to the state to administer to begin with. Anybody who wants to steal hay can buy the receipt. All you do is send 50 cents into the state, and they send you a pad of receipts. And it's a piece of legislation that is on the books in the state of Oregon that it just seems to me is an additional burden and expense to the taxpayers of the state. And at the same time, no sound rhyme or reason to it.
You and I are on a couple of bills that are putting more restrictions on things. Evidently, there's a lot of people that think there's no rhyme or reason to what the bills we have introduced here. I would like to hear from some of the farm people from around the state.
Any other questions, Mr. Chairman?
First question, Representative Stafford. No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Raymond.
Senator Archer, we have the
I did not identify this bill because I didn't know what it affected. I hadn't checked on it. We've had two different laws on hay hauling. First one was in 59, trying to help the producers of hay control the thieving of hay. The bill we put through that time, we had to repeal the next time. Finally, we put this one through at the recommendation of the hay producers. The big problem was that, of course, in your larger hay ranches, the way that they can get out and move is just like stealing cattle, in that they can go in and load in the backside of a field clear away from a person's home. No reason why that the state police would stop a truck unless they figured it was overloaded. So this way they can have either the receipt of the type that Representative Staffo said, or even written out on a piece of paper or anything like that I sold it at this time of day to this man, this truck, such and such a license, the number. So it's really a control, and it's been a big help. I don't like to say this, but I don't know whether it's the people from down this side that are buying our hay that they want a little, they don't like this because they don't like to pay for it or what it is. That isn't, of course, it is. But I just have to put it in a little bit. But I think it's something that is important. Now, he brought up in regards to refrigerators you don't have to have. Well, they're not going to be parked out in the field along the road, anything that's any good in regards to refrigerators, but the hay is always good, unless it's been out there for too long and not been taken care of and that. I think it's something that's very important because that is quite an industry. In fact, alfalfa is one of hay is one of the largest field crops that we have in this state, and there's an awful lot of it sold. And especially the producers up in Morrow, Umatilla County, as well as the ones that Representative Howard mentioned from Klamath Falls and some of those areas too that sell. And I think it's a very important law that we have on the books, and I would oppose this.
Question for Senator Raymond. Thank you very much, Representative Mann.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, very happy coincidence that I happen to be here to testify on another bill, because neither did I know that this bill was going to be heard today. And I would undertake to rebut the testimony of Representative Stathis. This is no added expense to the state, number one. It is indeed a necessity that hay growers of the state and to the people who possess a little pile of hay in the state. It provides two things. One, it gives the farmer who sells hay some indicia of the fact that he is owed an obligation by the person who bought it and doesn't pay for it at immediate time. In that respect, it compares with a bill that provides that a junk dealer has to pay, has to get a full report from anyone he buys the copper wire from. Now that protects the utility. Now this protects the farmer in the same way. So there is precedent for it. In addition to that, contrary to what the representative said, you can't transport cattle on the highways of this state without a similar indicator that you own the cattle and a bill of sale if there has been a sale. And so there is precedent there. The second thing this is used for is if a state policeman happens to see a man in a truck in a pickup late at night with 50 bales of hay, or even one, as in the case of the senator's son, then he has a reason to stop that man and find out if that hay is stolen. And if you find a pickup running down a dark road with 50 bales of hay on it at 3 o'clock in the morning, you can be pretty sure it was stolen. And without this bill, the state police would have no authority to make the stop. Now, if the representative wants to accept Jackson County from the operation of this bill, well, that's fine, but I don't think he should penalize the rest of the state just because a few of these hay growers may not like it. Representative Howard asked him, who asked him to write this bill? The senator asked him to write this bill. The same senator that he quoted against the rules of all the rules of the House. And in addition to that, the senator has put a repealer of this bill into the criminal law revision code that we're going to consider. And that's supposed to be a topical revision of our criminal law.
Question for Representative Mann.
Thank you very much.
Is there any further testimony on House Bill 1373? Seeing none, I'll end the hearing on 1373 and we'll turn to.
Representative
Howard moves that House Bill 1373 be tabled. Clerk, call roll.
Addison?
No.
Dinsmore?
No.
Pearson?
No.
Howard?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye.
Let's go to House Joint Memorial Number 6. House Joint Memorial Number 6, dealing with the Minum River. First call on Representative Mann.
Mr. Chairman, I hope that I haven't prejudiced my efforts on HJM 6. I'm trying to protect my people.
I almost got the job done on the arrow.
Oh, buddy. No, I was with you a little on that one.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would undertake to give you some background on House Joint Memorial 6 and what has led up to it. In the late 1950s, the Forest Service began to talk about building a road up the mine. And at that time, the Forest Transportation Plan, in capital letters, showed a road to be developed up the Minum as far as the mouth of the North Minum. A public hearing was held in May 23, 1961 at LeGrand, and at that meeting, which lasted all day, 36 people spoke against the proposal and 11 people spoke for it. In June 61, the Forest Service obtained a geological report which indicated that the road construction would be extremely difficult and costly. It stated that full bank design would necessarily be involved for much of the road. Much blasting would be required, and the highly dissected side slopes would compel numerous culverts and other drainage facilities, and there would be dangers of slides because of the morainal material lightly veneered to the canyon wall, which is now in a natural angle of repose and is very unstable. In June of 63, the regional forester met at Portland with representatives from conservation groups, including the Office of the Governor of the State of Oregon, and presented a modified plan which contemplated the addition of 11,225 acres to the Eagle Cap Wilderness Area and establishment of multiple use management activities of 23,000 acres of the Minum River Recreation Area. I might point out here that the Eagle Cap Primitive Area has been in existence for a long, long time, and in my earlier days spent many days in that area, which is a beautiful area, and it's very nearly adjacent to the area we're talking about. This plan contemplated a road extending the Little Minum to Little Minum and eventually into the recreation area proposed on the main Minum River. And parts of the construction were to be in connection with timber sales in the Little Minum area, and other parts were to be built with funds from regular Forest Service road appropriations. Strong opposition to the proposed road was expressed, and the plan was then further revised, and in October 1963, the proposed extension of the Eagle Cap area was increased to 13,500 acres. The plan was then committed to the chief forester in Washington. Soon thereafter, the Forest Service determined not to initiate road building or other action programs which would affect the area's physical status as it existed prior to the first proposal made in 1961. When the Wilderness Act of 1964 became law, it was necessary to commence studies in the primitive areas, and their suitability for wilderness is required by the Wilderness Act. Those activities temporarily prevented the Forest Service from further study of the Minum River. At Forest Service Advisory Council meeting in LaGrande in 1965, John Rogers, the Forest Supervisor, gave assurance that there was a moratorium on road building and the Minum drainage pending further studies. The regional forester subsequently gave similar assurances, and after that, anyone who called that office was given that type of assurance. While the moratorium was in effect, conversations with the regional forester indicated that he still favored access roads into the Minum River Canyon and proposed car camp sites on the Minum River. Governor Hatfield's support for preservation of the Minum was sought in 1966, and he agreed to view the area involved. After viewing it, he agreed that the Minum River Canyon should be preserved, and in 1968 introduced in the United States Senate a bill to add the Minum River Canyon to the Wilderness Preservation System. The bill was reintroduced in the 91st Congress as Senate Bill 1142, and a hearing was held in Washington. The Forest Service opposed the legislation and said that there's not been enough study. Actually, the Wilderness Act does not establish as a prerequisite to legislation concerning wilderness a study and recommendation by the Forest Service. It simply provides that the Secretary of Agriculture shall, within 10 years, review as to suitability or non-suitability for preservation as wilderness the areas in the National Forest classified as primitive. Forest Service also assures that the area does not qualify for wilderness because of previous logging, which I want to explain to the committee. And two resorts on other private lands in the area. Previous logging was done by horse from 1916 to 1923, involved only 1,600 acres, and the stumps are now so rotted and deteriorated that they would not be noticed unless pointed out. They are among stands of large pine. Selective logging was done at that time, and many pine then left are now quite large trees. Actually, stumps in wilderness are not unusual. In making trails or removing blow down, trees are necessarily cut and stumps left. Many wilderness areas contain prior logging. The Bob Marshall Wilderness Area in Montana contains about 80,000 acres that was forced logged in the early 1900s. The Wilderness Act makes specific provision for private lands within the wilderness, and your map shows the two areas of private land. Section 5 of the Wilderness Act is entitled State and Private Lands Within Wilderness Areas. There is reference in that section to privately owned land, quote, completely surrounded by national forest land within areas designated by this act as wilderness, unquote. The Forest Service has itself adopted regulations pertaining to surrounded private lands within wilderness. Almost all wilderness areas have in holding. The Eagle Cap itself has private land at Aneroid Lake. Being in the wilderness area, in fact, will enhance the value of the two of the private holdings in the area. Prior to the construction of Hell's Canyon Dam, 29% of the salmon which passed McNary Dam spawned in the Upper Snake. No salmon passed Hell's Canyon Dam, and the lower tributaries of the Columbia now have greater significance to the salmon fishery for spawning purposes. The Minum River is considered by the Fish Commission and the Game Commission to be an important spawning stream for coho salmon and steelhead. I think, Mr. Chairman, to turn to the bill, it speaks for itself. It describes the Minum as a crystal clear stream. It is important for recreation, important for spawning, and important for the preservation of the Wallowa elk herd. It points out that roads in the Minum would result in the hazing of this elk herd, and you, Mr. Chairman, are well aware of what happens to an elk herd if that happens. They disappear and go someplace else. It speaks to the, in line 16, to the erosion of the soil mantle, and which would increase the suspended particulate matter in the Minum River, thus destroying the spawning gravel and polluting the otherwise transparent waters of the Minum River. I think the memorial itself speaks eloquently. I would like to point out further that in the news release of October 12, 1970, Congressman Ullman said if reelected, he would introduce legislation in the 92nd Congress to place part of the Minum area in wilderness status and establish a new roadless category for the lower reaches. Now, this legislation has not yet been forthcoming, but I feel that if this body passes this bill, it will give, should give, great emphasis to the passage of the bill. I have with me a telegram which I'd like to read the committee. As the author of S-493, which would add the Minum River drainage to the existing Eagle Cap Wilderness, I offer my complete support for House Joint Memorial 6. Great statewide support exists for this. Oregon currently has less wilderness acreage than other western states. In his message on the environment last week, President Nixon called for, and this is a direct quote, a major enlargement of our wilderness preservation system by the addition of a wide spectrum of natural areas spread across the entire continent, unquote. Approval by the Oregon legislature of this memorial would assist in securing passage of this legislation. Sincerely, Marco Hatfield, U.S. Senator. I have also in my possession, Mr. Chairman, a letter from Mr. Herbert Frohlander of Corvallis, who could not be here, but speaks eloquently to the need for this bill and for the Oregon legislature to support our congressman in this effort. I will leave the correspondence with you and a statement if you'd like.
I'd like it. Question for Representative Mann. Representative McPherson.
Hey, man, I don't really know much about that part of the country over there. How does the Scenic Rivers Initiative affect the Minum? I thought it was the
Scenic Rivers Initiative will be very helpful to this cause. This part of the Minum, I understand, does come under the Scenic Rivers provision. However, there are no structures to speak of in this area as there are in the John Day and some of the other rivers that it speaks of. And there is no logging going on in this particular area right now. Scenic Rivers Bill speaks to permits for that type of activity alone.
But you don't think the Scenic Rivers Initiative then goes far enough?
too much flexibility left in the city of Rivers. Too much possibility for abuse.
I am in constant touch with the gentleman who is going to administer the Scenic Rivers Bill because I represent quite a few people who are involved, particularly on the John Day River. And I don't think, from the tenor of the regulations that are being drafted and so on, that under the Scenic Rivers Bill they would feel that they would have the power to enjoin logging as such, or to enjoin building a road as such. They would have the authority, you'd have to quote from the Act, but they would have authority only insofar as it destroys the scenic value of the river. This bill speaks to erosion, preservation of the elk herd, preservation of the spawning ground. And I don't think that the Scenic River Bill encompasses that broad spectrum.
Thank you very much, Senator Raymond. I'm Senator Raymond, representing the 17th Senatorial District, Umatilla, Union, and Wallowa County. I'd like to wear two hats today if I could, Mr. Chairman. I'll first speak to as Ruff Raymond and not as a senator in regards to this. I have a few things to say. For instance, we rent approximately 18,000 acres that we run cattle on up in the Laos, north of this particular area. And we have, that's one of our big problems, the elk. They're really multiplying and doing a good job there and tearing out our fences and all such as that. And of course eating the grass, but we are using multiple use of that pasture. Logging, pasturing, and wildlife. And I think it's doing a darn good job. So I, as Ruff Raymond, am not in favor of this bill. But to represent this area and all, I won't take a lot of time on my own, but I would like to quote a letter. As immediate past county judge of Wallowa County and as a citizen of Wallowa County, I object to a hearing of this nature being held in Salem with no notice given to the people of this area when the subject matter deals with about 80,000 acres of land mostly within our county. I would guess it's probably about 50-50 on it. I so testified before Senator Hatfield when he held his now famous impartial hearing in LeGrand on the Minim. I am sure that you must be aware that the only people who will be able to attend your hearing will probably be those in the Portland-Salem area. Those of us who will be vitally affected by locking this area up, who will be affected by the loss of timber production and the increase of timber diseases, it will not be afforded the opportunity of making our position known. Therefore, I request that a hearing be held in Enterprise before any action is taken. Sincerely yours, S. J. Ferris. And I would like to emphasize that I think it would be a wonderful thing before any action is taken on this is for you to come up and have hold a hearing up there and see some of that country.
I make a motion.
No motions will be considered. We have a lot of testimony. I was curious. Inflection time from that letter where you read that one part.
No, but that, pardon me, I was as a senator. That is, I should probably shouldn't have emphasized it quite so much.
We've already had several suggestions. Representative Anderson thinks we ought to have a hearing at point A on the ranch, which is labeled R. Higgins, 60 acres. You want to go to the other green, 167.
Mr. Chairman, the sponsor of the bill, I get to go with you.
All right, question for Senator Ramsey.
The other thing, may I just add one little thing, it's quite interesting to have people in other areas of the state so interested in our area, especially if the bill was put in just for the mine of us. There have been other areas why I would have thought, well, that wasn't too bad. If you look over all of it, just like the Scenic River bill, that is fine. It took in a lot of the others and you couldn't say, well, come up and see, but this affects just one stream, and it's in my district. So.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question? Was this judge notified, or did he ask for the hearing?
He heard, pardon me, I say, Mr. O'Hammond, he heard this over the radio station at Enterprise. That's where he heard of the business.
Representative Howard, you're familiar. Unfortunately, we cannot send notice until everyone
might
be
interested. I wanted to hear
through the public media, unfortunately, on the situation like this, not all of us find out. But I think we should consider further hearings. Further questions for Senator Wren? Not Rob, thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Representing Patterson.
I'm representing Patterson and the Minum River lie in the 24th district. I represent two counties, Blau County and Newman County, and the Minum River divides the two counties, as you can probably see on your map. And my purpose for being here is to express some of the opinions of my constituency. And not so much as to the pros and cons of the Minum itself, but as to the value of the House Memorial. I'm sure it's been already pointed out that there is a moratorium on that river, or somewhere in 2 or 3 years in a 10-year moratorium on logging and road building in the area. So most of the citizens that have contacted me have not felt like there was a need for a great rush into forming a wilderness area there. Perhaps in the way of a little history on the Minum and the way it affects the persons living in Blau Union County, it's been a fairly controversial matter for a number of years. There's been much talk over the past 10 or 15 years about the area itself. The Scenic Waterways Bill that was passed in last November, the general election, I believe it was, did include the Minum River, and it was the only river included in its entirety on the Scenic Waterways Bill, which does set aside a 1.5-mile strip up the entire length of the river. Many people in the area indicated they thought this was enough as far as the lockup principle. I think it's my duty as an elected representative to inform you, the committee considering this, of the opinions and the contacts that have been made to me in the past week since the notice has been out that this committee would hear HGM 6. I received a call yesterday from the Joseph Chamber of Commerce, and Joseph is a small town in Blau County that has a population of about 1,200 people. 200 of those belong to the Joseph Chamber of Commerce. It's the most active body in the city. And they have taken a poll of all their members and unanimously are opposed to the Minum River being included in any wilderness area. I was contacted by the chairman of a committee presently appointed by the Blau County Judge, by the Blau County Court, called the Economic Development Program Committee, consisting of 26 representatives, 24 of whom were at a meeting held on Monday evening and voted unanimously to their disapproval of HJM 6. The Blau County Board of Realtors took a telephone poll of all their members and were unanimously opposed to HJM 6. I have a number of telegrams, one of which came from the Blau County Judge opposing HJM 6, and a letter from the former judge of Blau County. I have had no, and in all honesty, no communication has been made with me in support of HJM 6 from either Union or Blau County. I think the concern that generally is expressed by most of the individuals living in the area is a resentment of others taking so much interest in their area in this way. I think most of them that I have had a chance to talk to about this have indicated that there are alternatives to handling this area, that they would like to see what can be done as far as development goes, and are not convinced in their own minds that locking up the area in a wilderness area and adding this section of the forest to the Eagle Cap Wilderness is necessary. I took the, I think was pointed out to you that Congressman Ullman is working on such an alternative. Many of these people hold some hopes for his proposal. So I did call Congressman Allman yesterday and ask if he has made any progress on his proposal, and he indicated to me that his personal feelings about the area and about the bill that Senator Hatfield has in his communications and dealing with the House committee that will be considering this, and he said very candidly that Hatfield's bill would not have a chance of getting to the House committee that was going to consider this. He is working on alternatives and a way to draft such a bill that the House committee will approve of, waiting now for a mineral survey, and he's also surveying some other potential areas in around Eagle Cap Wilderness for investigating the possibility of establishing these areas as also parts of the Minum area as parts of the Eagle Cap Wilderness area. His main concern was that the proposal that does go through should be studied in depth. It should at least have a fighting chance in the committee in Congress to pass, and indicated that Senator Hatfield's bill would go through the Senate but would not pass the House committee hearing. And with that, that's all I have.
Questions for Representative Patterson? Representative McPherson?
I hear shades of the beach bill in your testimony. You see, it all depends on whose ox is being gored. There was a time when my constituents thought that the rest of the state should not be interested in what was happening down on the beaches. And they wrote letters of protest, and I'm sure that if I had been let them spend time to take the polls, I would have gotten the same results you would have gotten from my constituents. And I wonder if you see any similarity between the two.
I see great similarity, Representative Cruz.
So if we were going to rise above politicians, we would pass this resolution.
Well, in some people's opinion, yes.
Tell me, do you think there's any truth in this editorial which says that Allman is not pushing for having the Minum area created as a wilderness area, that he's dragging his feet? In essence, that's what this says.
Well, I'm sure, Representative McPherson, that in your duties down here as a state legislator, that you find that you put different things on different priorities. And in my conversation with Congressman Allman, I think he is committed to a program to establish a larger wilderness area along the Eagle Cap, in addition to the Eagle Cap Wilderness area in that county. Whether he's dragging his feet or not, I could not make a statement. He sounded very sincere to me over the telephone and has spent many hours and inspecting and being with us up in Union Wallowa County. So I can't be very objective except to give you my personal opinion.
I sympathize with you, Representative Patterson, about having other people concerned themselves with the business of Union Wallowa County. But I'd be interested to know what will happen to those people that will upset them. If, in fact, the Minum River Canyon is included in the National Wilderness Preservation System.
The economic impact, I'm sure, will be spoken to here today, but that's basically the concern of many. And that is the economic impact and the allowable timber cut that and our major industry in the Sioux County area is lumber. And as I indicated, I think the economic impact is their greatest concern. To be very truthful, I have a feeling that, and I have a peculiar situation representing two counties that have sometimes very varied and separate opinions about different issues. I would say in Union County, for instance, it has a little broader economic base, that the opinions would split about 50-50 on whether to include the Minum area in the wilderness area or whether to keep it the way it is. In Wallowa County, the economic impact would be much greater felt, and I think there's about a 95% feeling up there that they would not like to take this out of the allowable timber cut consideration.
How much timber is in this? This area, Senator Hatfield. How much merchant timber?
I would have to defer that to someone who has made a study of the timber.
Well,
is most of this, are you familiar with this proposal?
Yes.
How much of that ground is private, how much of it is publicly owned? Do you know that?
Not the total acreage, no. There's approximately 80,000 acres in that proposal. There are, I'm not sure what the sizes are, the privately owned lots there. Not lots, but areas.
Would you have an estimate as to the percentage of ownership?
Of private ownership?
Yeah, versus public.
660 acres, and that one, Georgia Pacific, and then it gives the boys of the Cascade, and gives the others.
I have not seen that particular piece of paper that you have there. If it's on there, then there's no reason for the question.
Some of the figures
don't
have it, I
would say it's somewhere around 1%. It's a very
small. I see. These little red areas supposed to indicate the privately owned. I see. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that. All the rest is public.
That's the right on the top.
In July 69 hearing, Washington said that the area involved contained about 800 billion board feet of timber and represented an annual allowable cut of about 900 million board feet. What's the total annual allowable cut?
There's a formula for computing how much timber can be cut from any given area, and parts of this is included in that formula, although there's no logging done in the area now. And the impact of these figures, I can't tell you.
Do you have any idea what the cut is now in Union and Mojave counties?
The total cut?
Yeah, from all sources, private. No. Just trying to figure out what kind of an impact it is, actually. You can see where I'm getting.
Mm-hmm.
Patterson, do I assume from your testimony your position now is really neither for it or against this memorial? Based one on the moratorium that you and Representative Mann spoke to, plus your indications there's going to be some new information, some new direction in the near future that you think should be looked at?
Yes, without exception, there's no one I have talked to who would like to completely log off the Minor or in any way harm the elk herds there. I think our concern is for a viable alternative and you're putting a fence around it. The area now is relatively inaccessible except by horseback or somebody in good physical condition. There are numerous plans that can be alluded to as far as the development, the recreational development of this area. I have no personal preference as to what is the best development of the area. My personal opinion is that it's a great resource. I don't want to destroy it, but I want to make sure that rather than building a fence around it and say only you have the financial background to either hire a horse string or fly into a dude ranch can use it and just use it as a little private playground for those that are wealthy enough. I think there are other alternatives that should be investigated, and all I'm saying is that we don't want to jump into it, and basically it would be my only opposition to HJM6 is that we would like to see the other alternatives offered to us first and let us investigate those. They haven't been at this point.
Thanks.
Now there is only one, that's Senator Hatton.
Thank you very much, and appreciate it.
Thank you.
For the benefit of those that have signed up previously, there is a legislative courtesy policy that legislators testify first on measures such as this, and therefore I've gone away from the order in which you signed up. I'd like now to call, and before I call, our George Reed to be the next witness. I would point out we have a great number of telegrams and letters. I haven't gone through all of them generally in support of this measure, which will be entered in the record. Bill.
Chairman, members of the committee. My name is George Reed, Executive Director of the Oregon Wildlife Federation in the Executive Building for us. This federation statewide with membership of clubs and of individuals of about 8,000. I'm the chairman of the Federation Public Lands Committee. In cooperation with our Eastern Oregon Club, we have personally taken a real close look at the entire Minim Canyon many times. We have attended all the meetings and hearings on this question for the last 10 or 12 years. The Oregon Wildlife Federation passed a resolution on June 18, 1961, and again on June 20, 1965, supporting efforts to add that portion of the Minim drainage now outside the existing wilderness to the Eagle Cap Women's Area. I have copies of both these resolutions and quite a bit of background committee or material that I have turned in. We respectively urge this committee to support HJM 6 as presented. In addition, I might add that my first trip into the Minim was in 1938, my last was 1970. Since 1949 until January the 15th, 71, I've lived in Baker. This gave me an opportunity to become extremely well acquainted with every mile of the canyon and every mile of the stream and its two major tributaries. I could go on for 30 minutes about the mining, but in deference to the people behind me, I would say that would be the end of my testimony.
Thank you, Jerry. Questions for Mr. Reed? Representative Annan.
Mr. Reed, do I understand a wilderness area, quote unquote, allows only what kind of use? On foot or horseback or what?
The wilderness area, the wilderness bill called for no motorized equipment of any kind. Now, remembering that the upper 18 miles plus of this river is already within the Eagle Cap wilderness area, all this bill is attempting to do is to move the boundaries north to encompass more of the Minim Valley.
In effect, what you're doing is limiting some citizens of Oregon's access to part of this area.
No, I'm afraid not, because there are in the neighborhood of 14 trails going into the Minim Valley from all four sides at the present time. And as I stated, my first trip was in 1938, and I remember this very well because it was a backpack trip. In the ensuing 20 years, the last previous 20 years, I have made many trips in the area several times a year, generally horseback. And I'm amazed at the continued use of all types of people, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, troops in 30 and 40 and 50 in a group that use the area for a week at a time.
How would you propose to get somebody in a wheelchair?
I assume, of course, it's the same way we would propose to get them up to the Mount Jefferson Wilderness. That's we could fly them into the two major dude ranches in there, and the Wilderness Act would allow these uses to continue under certain written-in recommendations.
And allow special provisions.
This would be excluded from wilderness. These acres would be excluded from wilderness.
Thank you.
Senator Howard.
Mr. Reed, yep. The Oregon Wildlife Federation supports the National Dunes Park.
Yes, we do. We have in the past, and we do.
Both the members available now being.
Yeah, we supported the effort years ago to get a national park, and we. Certainly support the effort now to get a recreation area.
Rogue River Wilderness Area.
Yes, sir.
And
I might add, for your benefit, gentlemen, the Federation is a multiple use organization. The only time recently that we haven't gone along with the wilderness proposals is in the French Feet area. We cast our lot with the Forest Service.
You just don't support this.
We believe that this area with its busy timber should be cut as proposed by the Forest Service Management as proposed.
Further questions? No, thank you very much, Charlie. FM Fresno, Portland.
Thank you.
for sale.
You don't have to read the whole thing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Russ Fredsall, Research Forester for Western Wood Products Association. We are opposed to a memorial calling for a Minim Wilderness addition to Eagle Cap because we're convinced that this would not be the highest public use of this beautiful piece of country. Wilderness can be a legitimate land allocation only when it is in concert with the most beneficial land use pattern possible for a forest. It can only be considered a true element of multiple use plan when in balance with other potential necessary uses. Our study has revealed that a highly restrictive classification such as wilderness is not necessary to protect the water, wildlife, and fish values of the Minim. Indeed, they could be better managed with access through the Little Minim, which has been suggested. There are some very real questions as to whether the Minim, as a unit, is an area of true wilderness quality. I think you'll probably hear quite a bit on this subject today. I will not pursue it unless you care to take the time. I have attached a copy of a rather lengthy statement which I presented last July at the Senate field hearing on the Minim, which elaborates on some of these points. What we challenge most, particularly in the Minim proposal, is the need for a larger wilderness here. It is true that people tend to crowd in certain localities of Eagle Cap in recent years, but will adding more land solve that problem? We think not, since the same pressure exists on all land uses, most others more so than wilderness. I have attached a copy of our latest forest land withdrawal impact system for your information. This compilation showing withdrawal cases pending with a gross area of 16.5 million acres and timber inventory of over 65 billion board feet should allay fears of those concerned about vanishing wilderness. This covers the 12 western states where our association works. We are certain that the wilderness preservation system will at least double and perhaps treble in the next 5 years. The total system is presently one-third productive forest land, and Eagle Cap has 55,000 acres of this, which belies the wilderness on the rocks myth. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Who do you represent, sir?
Western Wood Products Association.
Okay. If I understand your argument, you say the withdrawal case is in, just in Oregon, 65 billion
no.
board feet?
No, that is in the 12 western states. There is a summary on Oregon in there, though.
Well, how much is Oregon?
Well, I would have to look it up. It changes about every week. But presently, for the state of Oregon, we have listed a total of 732,890 acres total in wilderness or land withdrawal cases of one type of another, and 267,000 acres of that is productive forest land. And
board footing spaces. Now, let's go pick it up in Oregon. You're talking about a withdrawal factor of 65 billion board feet, 12 western states. Now, do you know what that is in Oregon?
Well, these are really only partial totals because, as yet, certain information isn't available. It takes time.
I want to
go
on the basis on your figure, $65 million.
We have a total, a partial total for the state of Oregon of $3.5 billion.
$3.5 billion.
Yes.
And what is the total available board footage of merchantable timber in Oregon?
I can't answer that.
Well, now you're asking us to be alarmed by the fact
fact that they're 3.5 billion board feet on the drawing board for withdrawal. Now, for some comparison, in order to cause me to be alarmed, I'm going to have to figure out how much that is.
Well, Representative, I wasn't trying to alarm you. I was just trying to show what the total land withdrawal picture looks like.
Are you familiar with the report that was done by an interim committee during the last session of legislation by Wes Rickard, who is also a forest consultant?
Yes, I am.
And as a matter of fact, he said that Oregon could presently double its allowable cut and still continue on a sustained yield basis. Is that a fact?
That's correct.
And that, was based upon the fact that that over 50% of the public forest alone is not even eroded at this time.
Yes, and this is primarily what we're talking about now. This is where all the controversy centers. We've on unroded areas, and we maintain that many of these unroaded areas should, in fact, be managed as multiple-use areas, although many of them are suitable for wilderness and other limited-use designations, and we often support these proposals.
With a lowering of the cycle, we get the Forest Service down from 100 years to 80 years, in line with Bureau of Land Management. And if we can practice some intensive forest management, which the Forest Service cannot do, like funds, all their funds go back, you know, and that if we can grow some of the forests in our folder, do we need to be concerned about 3.5 billion board feet?
No, I think that this is only an indication of the magnitude of the problem. We are convinced that ultimately in this country, that we're going to need all the wood fiber we can grow on productive forest land that is not in reserved or restricted classification. So this is what we're looking at, the long pull.
In other words, you're looking for more and more mine and wilderness areas that are going to withdraw your production.
This is precisely what we're worried about. We're trying to protect our productive forest land base. So the resource will be available.
Where's the middle ground?
Well, it's somewhere between making a wilderness area out of all the unroaded public lands and using them all for timber harvesting and other uses. Somewhere in the middle of that, I assume. But we feel that definitely in the next 5 years, the wilderness preservation system will more than double.
Let me ask you one more question. As I understand it, John L. Rogers, Forest Supervisor, the Forest Service for that area, in a letter of July 22, 1970, said that in fact the Forest Service had placed the timber of the Lion River drainage in an administrative reserve. Does that indicate to you that there's not going to be any timber coming out of that area anyway?
Well, the way things are going lately, it's a pretty good sign that it won't be, but it was just in a deferred category for a later determination based on studies, and it's quite possible that part of that area could be back in, and the allowable cut was still partially calculated on that acreage.
Thank you very much, sir.
Representative Howard.
Well, is that fast growing timber up there or slow?
Well, it's an extensive area and it varies quite a bit, but my observations up there, there is some very good productive forest land for east side forest.
How long to produce a good first row?
Well, it'd be just a shot in the dark. Takes a lot of study, but I imagine that that could be successfully managed as a part of a larger unit on a 90-year rotation or something like that.
90-year cycle.
Yes, but I would suspect, Representative, that the type of cutting that would be done in an area like that would be modified by the recreational or scenic values there. So it wouldn't be a full harvest anyway.
Well, But if we did let it be first, who would be the power of the fee? Would it be clear cut? Would it be selective logging? Forest Service that would supervise it? Or who does it under the National Park if it's ever done?
Well, if it was in a park, why, there probably
never would be
a wilderness. Well, the Wilderness Act does say that timber can be taken to control insect epidemics or salvage fire kill, but it's never done.
How can you get it done?
Well, they can, if they have to, they can build roads into wilderness areas under the Act for emergency purposes.
How close are the forest resources to logging with helicopters or balloons?
Well, helicopters are being used in experimental operation in California right now, and they certainly can do the job as far as the physical part of it. The only problem is that the machine costs about $1,200 an hour to run, so you couldn't make an economic business out of it at this time, but it, the physical capability is there.
How about the blues?
Well, this has been quite successful in certain areas, but it's mainly for patch cuts and this type of thing, whereas the any timber harvesting in the Minim, if it ever was allowable, would probably be on a maintenance basis and a rather selective basis, so that it wouldn't have an adverse impact on scenic value. So
I think this is what we should be interested in, is that if it is a wilderness area, that the economy of tree logging continues, but still if we maintain it at a good level. I disagree with some of the things the forest industry does, but at the same time, I realize that it's a necessity, that economic necessity, that we have logging, and I hope that someday we can find that happy medium that you're talking about.
Well, we think in this area that you could more or less have your cake and eat it too, because there is wood that can be produced out of there and without harming the fishery or anything else. Just for that.
Further questions? No, thank you very much. Dave Reed.
Pardon me, Dan Reed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I represent the Committee for Minim Action and Friends of the Earth. The copy you see here is testimony I presented last fall at the hearing of the grant. Inasmuch as this has been gone over and will be gone over more in this meeting, I'd like to just say a few brief words. I've been going into the Minim River since 1945, and every year that I have gone in there, perhaps 12 to 14 times, I have seen more people every year. Last year, I spent 1 week in the Big Minim Meadows with 14 groups. 3 years previously, there was one group, and years before that, there were no groups camped in that area. The pressure on the Eagle Cap Wilderness is becoming exponentially greater every year, and more people are using the lower Minim River in respect to the fact that they wish to get away from these other people. It's an area of great scenic beauty. It is unique in that it is a low-level canyon and can be used in the early parts of the year, while the upper regions of the Eagle Cap Wilderness Area are still snowed in and are unavailable for people to use. Important reason that I see for maintaining that lower canyon roadless is for the Minim River elk herd. The elk must come down from the high country when there is a mantle of snow in the high country. They must use a low-level canyon for their winter range. These canyons are becoming fewer and fewer as all-weather roads are being used for logging purposes, such as over in Looking Glass and other areas like the Nimnes area, not too far from the Minim. In other respects, I feel that the Minim in itself is a very unique canyon. In respect to people who are unable or unwilling to exert effort to walk in or use horses, I have taken an invalid person up the East Eagle and have shown them this canyon. I say to them, this canyon looks like the Minim River. This canyon looks like the Minim River would look today if it had been roaded. And in this canyon, you will see cat tracks down trees and general havoc left from logging, with no apparent consideration by the Forest Service for generating recreational value. So I feel that one should leave just a few of these low-level, unroaded canyons for our generation and for future generations.
Mr. Reed, I agree with you. We should leave. And I have hiked the Minim from, as shown here on the map, out to the end of what is the proposed wilderness area. She's one of the sponsors in the last two sessions of the City Rivers Bill. And do you really think that there's going to be a road built on the Minim?
Not if I can have anything to do with it.
Not if the law is observed, as far as I'm concerned, on the Minim Canyon. Now, if you're talking about areas that are on either side of it, but as far as the Minim Canyon is concerned, that's what that whole law was about. As far as I'm concerned, I don't really particularly disagree with representing the man. The new director of that thinks that the law says different, so we got to find a new director. But I have some question as to how, I have real doubts that there's going to be any kind of man-made structure on the lower Minim, unless it were approved. And I would be the first one there to fight any suggestion that the board governing the Tenney Rivers Bill ever approve any kind of construction on the Minim Canyon. I share the same concerns that you have for the elk herd and for preservation of the lower Minim Canyon.
I'm basing some of my concern on the 1960 ad hoc position of the Forest Service, which is the last statement I have received from them, in which they wish to run a road down the Little Minim Canyon, the mouth of that canyon, and extend the road 2 miles in each direction with improved campsites. I have not heard one word from the Forest Service since publicly that they have changed their position.
They're going to pick a fight with the federal department, but I dare them to do it.
I would too.
Or not to do it, but to even suggest to do it under the City Rivers Bill that's passed by the state of Oregon.
I'd like to hear from the new director of the Scenic Rivers Bill and have him. I don't want to take anybody else's word for it. I'd like to have him sit right there and tell the committee what he thinks the bill will do.
Questions for Mr. Reed?
One question. Philosophical question about the point of the eye, probably many, many times in the future. And you certainly have to talk about yourself representing an environmental group.
Yeah.
And there's going to be more and more practice between the question of who's brought up and people like them and environmental groups. So where is the compromise? That's the same question I asked you. And it was bad to hear you say that we have to set aside a few of these. And that's a reasonable approach, I think. Not all, and some might have. So where do you think that compromise ground is?
Oregon has 1% of its forest land, perhaps less than 1% in wilderness. The average for the 11 western states is 2%. California has 5% set aside as wilderness. Oregon does not have its justified quota of wilderness areas, in my opinion, set aside for recreation.
What do you think in your mind is a fair, is there some percentage based upon the amount of population that we have and can expect that should be set aside? Is there a criteria for it?
My feeling is that one pick recreation or wilderness areas left, you would find so few, you would have very little to do with the available timber left. In other words, we're talking about micro areas. Many of the areas are already wilderness. They could have been wilderness areas.
Question. Thank you very much, Mr. Green. Peter Remsey.
Copy of the testimony I gave last summer at the Senate hearing in the Grand. And in the single space pipe, I have a summary of the abstract of that. I hope you have time to read the other testimonies, but I think some of the points are out of it are kind of important. But I will read this summary I do have. The Minim River is essential not only for the purposes of wildlife and general ecological balance, but increasing evidence is demonstrating the preservation of this area, among others, is necessary for the survival and well-being of men. A case in point is the example of Scandinavian lemmings. Its peculiar behavior of mass suicide and its chaotic conduct have only recently been understood as a consequence of overpopulation and resulting glandular stress. The results of this research are not abstract and completed to the present human condition. However, the parallels regarding both the physiological and psychological processes are remarkable, if not disconcerting. Man's recent creation of an artificial enclosing environment, urbanization, and the other aspects, have not provided the variety of life prescribed under normal conditions. We find all the necessary symptoms for a lemming-type existence within all our cities from population 10,000 to a million or more. Increasing evidence is showing that science is failing in its objectives to make man compatible with his artificial environment. In fact, we do not know man's internal chemistry and psychical complexities and the interrelationship between man and his environment well enough to suggest that we are even asking the correct questions to ensure our survival beyond the current technological assault upon our environment. There is increasing evidence suggesting that mental health and emotional stability of populations may be profoundly influenced by frustrating aspects of an urban biologically artificial environment. It seems likely that we are genetically programmed to a natural habitat of clean air and very green landscapes. Thus, statistically, we find that urban dwellers are more likely to be wilderness vacationers than rural dwellers. Two most important reasons given are a desire to exit civilization and aesthetic religion. People need recreation areas which do not recreate the conditions experienced in the city as found in mass recreation areas. Thus, we find a phenomenal increase in wilderness use, to such an extent that human pollution and overuse has resulted in restricted usage. This factor must be considered before we destroy any wilderness. Importantly, the ties to the natural environment are most vital during youth. Thus, the greatest increase of use is found in the young. The United States has approximately 1% of its land area under asphalt and concrete, and that figure is rising at a phenomenal rate, and approximately 0.4% in wilderness areas. Oregon has only about 1% of its land area in wilderness areas, and this is among the most specific groups, specific states groups. And what wilderness there is primarily alpine and granite. The Minim River system is Oregon's last unroaded major river system and one of the few wooded river valleys left in the United States. This next section, I think, has been covered by some of these people. The arguments about multiple use, I think it's been fairly well substantiated that hearing testimony at the Senate hearing last summer showed that the mining was actually holding its own economically in the sense that more is being obtained from the region in terms of watershed, recreation, grazing, teaching, and scientific resources, and it's costing to maintain it. And the value of the fish hatchery and natural fish hatchery and these things are worth a great deal for the state of Oregon as well as the recreation potential of the region as it stands. And finally, I'd like to point out that people love the Minim. I was born and raised in Loran, and I think I have some understanding of the people who live here there, and I have a great deal of compassion and respect for them. And it was no surprise to me that a month-long poll taken by the LeGrand Observer, and I'm not sure if Patterson must not be aware of this, disclosed that the people supported wilderness inclusion of the Minim as stated in Senator Hatfield's bill, at that time U.S. Senate 1142, by a margin of 7-1. There's hardly an issue today which can claim such unanimity. We must do everything possible to see that the Minim is protected. Senator Hatfield's wilderness bill has received support in the U.S. Senate and needs corroborative support in the U.S. House of Representatives. The statement of H3M6 provides further expression of the will of the people on this issue. We must give the Minor River Wilderness Memorial our utmost support.
Randy, I'm going to have to ask you the same thing I did before. This testimony I consider to be quite pertinent last July when you were talking to Senator Hatfield about the U.S. bill, the Senate bill, at the time. Last November, we passed the Wilderness St. Rivers bill in the state of Oregon. And one of the things that was basically against my grain is that we constantly seek solutions to Oregon problems in Washington, D.C. The great seat of all wisdom, and they have a beautiful record for solving problems, you know, inexpensively and so forth. Why can't we find an Oregon solution? Why do we have to seek one in Washington, D.C.? And what was wrong with the solution that people passed last year?
Well, the way I understand the bill is would not protect certain areas outside the canyon, such as Little Minim and Bear Creek, which are important tributaries to Big Minim. And according to the Game Commission report, I think it was also substantiated that much of that area is used by the big game of the area. Also, the anadromous fish population could be very badly damaged if these areas were allowed to be polluted by logging and roading. The soil in that area is granitic type and very erodible. And the way I understand it, although that bill is a very good, it would not protect the area if logging was even allowed in the adjacent areas of the watershed.
Questions?
Mr. Rimby, are you serious that we are genetically programmed clean air and green landscape?
Well, the research of Let's see if I can fill out. Oh yes, this statement was taken from the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists of January 1970. And although, like I made the statement that we don't understand our genetic makeup, you know, to see if we can survive the type of things we're doing to our environment, there is that possibility open, and it seems to be a very good possibility that people need, and whether it is genetic or inherently needed or something that's taught to us. That's, in a way, a minor question. The fact that people are actually reacting to an enclosed environment this way seems to point this direction.
I suggest that we're not sure what people are reacting to. We may have some theories.
Yeah, certainly. I agree with you.
You're talking about setting off a wilderness area, and I'm not exactly sure what that is. You talk about the need in the future, and so do these other gentlemen. But you relate to the needs in the future to present-day practices. Are you concretely sure, and I don't know anything about logging, that couldn't be logged with practices that would maybe require they might know in 10 years? Are you completely sure that a few campsites in there with minimum travel would completely ruin that area? Do you make that statement? That erosion is going to occur, the riverbed is going to be eroded, the elk herd is going to be sent to climb a fault or somewhere? Or are these just fears?
Well, I think that a lot of these fears are based on very substantial evidence. For instance, there are other
present day evidence?
Yes, so. Yes. For instance, I can substantiate that the South Salmon River, South Fork of the Salmon River, was a similar situation of compared to the Minum about 10 years ago. And it was logged. And as a result, the anadromous fish hatchery in that river was ruined. Now, I believe that they got $1 million of timber out of the area, or something of that order. The Forest Service is now attempting to start a $4 million program to study, not to start study. Fish producing float program. So I think when you start measuring even in monetary terms, you run into problems because even to reproduce what you have, even then.
That you're speaking about improper practices or present day stupidity in the law. You're not really saying what could be done. Now,
well,
would you go on record as saying it's completely impossible with perhaps methods we don't know now? Can you assume that some new method will not be established in logging? Because you tell me that a few camping spaces, quite frankly, I'm somewhat disabled, and it irritates me when areas are completely shut off except to a few people. I don't think it's right.
I disagree with you there because it's not shut off to a few people. I think that, no, sir, I disagree because if a person wishes to walk, if a person wishes to do any of these things, if he wishes to do these things, he can. It's his will.
Devil to see me getting in there.
Pardon?
You play awful seeing me getting in there.
Well, I have very close friends who are felt the same way, and we've hiked in there together. And well, my father, for instance, who is not rich by any standards, he's rich. In fact, he's very low income, and we hiked in there now, and he works for his employee.
You are saying that there is absolutely nothing that's compatible that could be at all. 5 years, 10 years, new practices, new rules, anything.
I don't think that that's a relevant question at that point because
I don't consider that a relevant answer.
Well, I can't answer the question because I don't know.
Howard, may I ask, what is the University of Oregon Survival
Center? Last year, a class was started, which included about 6,000 people, the largest, at that time, the largest ecology class in the nation. people concerned about the survival of man. And out of this group of people who are concerned about the environment, we call them
I don't understand the word. People.
Well, there are not that many involved in it now, but at that time, in that one class, it was
you know, I'd like to call it a little bit of Jack breathing. We're presently logging, I say we, I mean, it's going on in the state of Oregon, with a balloon. And if this would timber was cut with without a collar saw, so that we were living up to the specifications of wilderness area. And if the timber were taken out by a balloon that no roads built, and was done on a very selective and a sustained real basis, would you see any great objection to this?
Well, I think maybe I can't answer that question. I just thought of something. It's a very basic question because the means of taking out this timber may not be the only question at hand. It's the result of removing that timber from that particular type of area. The ecological stability of the area depends on the timber being there.
But the wilderness area bill says that if the timber is deceased, they may take it out. Now, why can't we take it up when it's still in the productive use? If we have to just go in a wilderness area and take out the timber that has some kind of a disease, or do we go in and take out on a selective basis where there's no chance of a fire, that they buck it up with a saw or cut it with an axe and a saw, and it's hoisted up to the of the king on a very selective basis. You would still object to that.
Well, this is what I'm getting at. You see, the effect of removing that from the, let's say, the canyon wall, the kinds of erosion that would occur.
You plant trees in.
Yeah, but they're in different kinds of areas. I'm not a forester.
We cut selective lots of places before we do not have erosion.
Yeah.
These are steep canyons, and I know what they are. But just because you cut and leave us something, but if there's new trees growing, you get that erosion. In fact, the roads right there, it's a pretty dry area.
Yeah, and then when they have the smell of the runoff, it's when the really big erosion can occur.
I realize that this is a big philosophy that people have grabbed onto.
Well, maybe I could point out one thing. It was established at this hearing, that the allowable cut or the amount of timber in there would contribute about 0.5% to the total yearly economy of that region, which sort of shows that that this much timber isn't very substantial. And by those methods, by the president, like you say, it would probably just cost much
more. We're talking about economy. And now, if we went down to the University of Oregon and said, we can cut out so many classes, and it's only 1% of the economy of the University of Oregon, the kids would scream bloody murder. But now we're talking about going up into an area and we're locking in an industry. I think we have to look at the whole overall. We're talking about a percent. It depends on who's getting that percent taken.
Well, if the people of that area respond 7-1 that they want to put in wilderness, according to Senator Hatfield's bill, I think that maybe they should be represented that way.
I don't have all the answers.
I missed that.
I'd have to point out. Let's not start accepting newspaper polls as gospel.
Oh, I'm not. But there are other people.
That newspaper slightly credited in favor of.
At one time they were not.
Right.
They've gone back and forth. The one time they were very much against it. The newspaper. Thank you.
I just want to comment on the newspaper poll and the validity of it.
Thank you. Mrs. Jean R., I can't read the last name from Fennel.
Oh, I need to count your name, right?
I can't read it. It's pronounced if I could.
C-R-I-T-E, Christ.
Christ.
I attempt to read the testimony of State of Mind Incorporated, and when I finish is very brief, I would like to make some comments based on some of the testimony that has been previous. Mr. Chairman and fellow members, I'm Mrs. Jean Price from Pendleton, Oregon, Secretary of and representing State of Mind Incorporated, an organization which originated in LaGrange some 10 years ago dedicated to the protection of the Minum River Canyon. Since our organization was formed, we have witnessed the immense increase in the Hill Capital area usage. The Lower Minum Access opened earlier in the year and stays open later in the fall with an extremely high Hill Cap. Therefore, it can be used for a much longer season. Many families hike into this area to enjoy the solitude and unique wilderness experiences available. The Little Minum and Big Minum Canyons offer a rare opportunity for hunters wishing to use horses to hunt and pack. Individuals wishing the unexcelled native trout, steelhead, and salmon fishing can hike or ride into the area. The use in the present Eagle Cap wilderness is too heavy. The addition of the Minum River Canyon will alleviate this pressure and add a variety of natural experiences. Senator Hatfield is familiar with the area, knows of its unique offerings and the desires of the people. After hearing testimony at the public hearing in LaGrange on July 27, 1970, he was convinced that the addition of the Minum River Canyon was best for the area and the state of Oregon. State of Mind Incorporated fully supports Senator Hatfield's bill and Representative Mann's memorial. Thank you for the opportunity to express our concerns and desires.
You wanted to respond to some of the comments. Go right ahead.
There was a comment saying the newspaper polls weren't all that equal, but the newspaper polls was open to the public, everyone, to respond to it. I wanted to express the concern of the Chamber of Commerce poll. We had people at this hearing, businessmen in LaGrange, for instance, that just resigned from the Chamber of Commerce because it presented testimony that the Board of Directors only had presented, and the general membership was not involved in the whatsoever. And Representative Anson? You can go to mine, that's for sure. The what? Oregon Kings River Bill protects the last 80 miles, well, the whole thing. The last 8 miles, there is a road up to the wilderness boundary or full wilderness boundary. And there is a road there, so of course you can see the moon, and it will still be crystal clear down there if there is fog enough above. And of course, you can always fly the clients to do this. This would be an excellent opportunity. The Wilderness Act of 1964 permits the continued use where motorized vehicle travels in the area, in this case, may continue. So this is a wonderful opportunity for a woman to spend.
In your philosophy of this type of area, do you see the day coming when you're going to limit the people that can go into these areas?
Very definitely.
Say you're overcrowded.
Definitely. Because these areas...
would you suggest anything like that at this time?
It's inevitable. It will happen, definitely.
Right now. So we should start limiting, saying only you got to have a pass or a permit to go in on this weekend, like we're doing in the state park.
Well, this is personal opinion, but I believe in the Lake Basin they definitely should restrict traffic this time in the capital in this area. Now, this year, there will be some of the lights closed off to horse traffic in Eagle Cap, which is necessary because it's high alpine country, and it's extremely sensitive to the delicate. Horses are harmful, that's for sure, particularly up in the lakes where there is very limited horses. And when, may I make a comment on this?
Go ahead.
On Senator Raymond, I thought was when he presented person testimony thought he was afraid that there would be no grazing allowed, but the wilderness act there again, 1964, does permit this where it has been established.
Further questions?